Hello, welcome to Convergent Dialogues. This is Xavier Bonilla. On this episode, I am very happy to bring the conversation I had with Helen DeCruz. Helen is the Danforth Chair in the Humanities at St. Louis University. She has two PhDs. She's got a PhD in philosophy from the University of Groningen and a PhD in archaeology and art sciences from the Free University of Brussels. Much of her work examines why and how humans engage in pursuits that seem remote from the immediate concerns of survival and reproduction, such as theology, mathematics, and science. She's the author of many books, including the most recent, Wonderstruck: How Awe and Wonder Shape the Way We Think. This is what we talk about in the conversation. We start out by defining awe and wonder as distinct emotions. We talk about awe in other animals, talk about social and cultural aspects of awe, and philosophy being born in wonder. We talk about the history of awe and wonder from ancient Greece to the Enlightenment, theories of emotions, magic and wonder, religion and wonder. We talk about Merleau-Ponty and habits, spiritual naturalism, and many other topics. I've actually been mutuals with Helen online for many years, and I've always wanted to get her on and talk to her, and I saw she had a new book out, so the timing seemed right. She is an absolutely lovely person, super brilliant, very, very thoughtful, love the way she thinks. She's just a really good human being all around, and just an absolute joy with this conversation. And I can't recommend her book more highly. It's very readable. It's very digestible, and it's definitely a book that is thoughtful. It will make you think and ponder about many of these concepts. And so, just all wonderful topics that she gets into. As always, you can find this conversation and all other conversations at convergingdialogues.substack.com. I'm also on YouTube. So definitely get over there, subscribe if you haven't, follow, like, share, word of mouth, sharing with your friends, sharing online, writing reviews, all that stuff really, really helps. And if you want to contribute as well, that's also super helpful. Much appreciated for those that do already. Really helps me to keep going forward. Again, this is all kind of a DIY, if you will, right? I'm not, as you know, I resist the urge to do ads and sponsorships and all those things, and I don't plan on it anytime soon. I want it to be all from listeners. So I really do appreciate the contribution and don't feel shy to engage at all on the Substack. It's got some really great features there to engage with me directly. And so now I bring you Helen DeCruz. I am here with Helen DeCruz. Helen, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. I am greatly looking forward to talking with you.
Likewise. Nice to talk to you.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. It's we were just talking before we got on of how we've kind of maybe have mutual friends. I think we follow each other online, things like that. And so you have a new book out, which is just lovely. It's a fabulous book. I really, really enjoyed it. The book is called Wonderstruck: How Wonder and Awe Shape the Way We Think. And so we can talk about wonder and awe for the next bit of time here. Before we do, why don't you just tell listeners briefly kind of the thumbnail sketch of who you are professionally, academically, and what you currently are into.
Okay, so I'm Helen DeCruz, and thank you so much for tuning in and listening. I'm currently the Danforth Chair in the Humanities holder at St. Louis University. I got my PhD at the University of Groningen, Rijksuniversiteit Groningen, which nobody in the English-speaking world can pronounce. It's a Dutch university with an ancient history. In 2011, and I have an earlier PhD in archaeology and art sciences.
So you have two PhDs.
Yes, wow. I have a background in art and archaeology.
Wow.
I'm interested in, why do people make art and, do science and things like that. That's what really interests me. Like, why do we do the stuff that doesn't seem like it's going to help us survive and reproduce, but we do it anyway.
Yeah.
So
that's great. And so you're currently teaching, right? Is that like kind of like your day job? You're teaching and doing research and writing, or?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I do a lot of service to the profession, as they call it. So I also am the editor-in-chief of our house journal, Res Philosophica. So I put quite a bit of work in that. So rejecting your papers or accepting your papers.
Very nice. It depends on the quality of the paper, or maybe the quality of the day.
Or the luck with the referees. Like you have to be lucky. I'm sorry.
That's hilarious. That's great. So I guess what kind of got you into writing this book to talk about wonder and awe? I mean, I can kind of see a little bit of the link there with art, I mean, or the aesthetic. But what is it about wonder and awe that you wanted to kind of talk about and write about and put for the general public?
I think this was a very concentrated project, to be honest. I got interested in awe and wonder several years ago, and I started writing about it. In part, I think if I had to put one sort of genesis to it, the direct reason I got interested is actually Richard Dawkins' work. So Richard Dawkins, I have a love-hate relationship with his work. I started reading him when I was 16, 17. And I was sort of like really, really into it, like The Blind Watchmaker and, you know, The Selfish Gene. And one thing that I got from early Dawkins, before he became all like wokeness has gone awry and things like that, before he became that kind of guy, he sort of gave a sense about how wondrous science is and how wondrous the world is, and how you don't actually, in his view, and I think that's right, but we can talk about that later, you don't really need religion to feel wonder. You don't need that. You can feel wonder in so many different ways. So I got really interested in that. And then I explored sort of the links between Dawkins and, you know, sort of people who come from it at a religious way, such as Abraham Joshua Heschel, the great Jewish philosopher. And that sort of got me thinking. I wrote a piece in Eon, an editor at Princeton got really interested and asked me, do you want to write a whole book about that? And I said, why, yes, I do. So that's it, basically, why. So it's Princeton basically said, just write a whole book about this. And I did.
Yeah, that's great. It's nice when you get a big university press just asking you to write a book on something. That's great. That's great.
Yeah.
I'm very sympathetic to a lot of what you said there. There was a bit of time, I think it was right before or during or after, I'm not sure where, it's sort of around this time where Dawkins had a pretty massive stroke, it was a really bad stroke, and he was out of the spotlight for a while. And I think he was writing right before that. I could be wrong on the timeline, but it's around there. About this idea of, you know, what the wonder we can get from science, and we don't need necessarily religion or things like that. And I think, you know, kind of post-stroke, he's kind of leaned in a little bit to the culture war stuff, which, you know, is and he's older now, and it's interesting just why he's choosing to talk about those things in his 80s, but whatever, it's his choice, I guess. But yeah, and his old stuff is great. You know, Extended Phenotype is, I think, probably his best work. It's amazing. It's a great book, So, okay, so awe and wonder, how are these, you know, and you talked about it in the beginning of the book of how do you define these, and how are they distinct emotions, if you will? They're not just synonyms for each other. Obviously, there's that, you know, overlap for sure, but how do you define awe and wonder?
For awe, it wasn't difficult to come up with a definition because there is a paper by Dacher Keltner, who wrote recently a great book on awe.
Yeah.
And Jonathan Haidt. They have this idea. And it's also validated. So there's a lot of empirical research coming out of this idea, namely that awe has two components. It has a component of vastness and a component of cognitive accommodation. What does that mean? It means that you are typically in awe of something that is vast, or rather you sort of get focused by the vastness. Like you can look at the night sky and you know, you get struck by it. You get struck by the night sky, by the vastness of it. And then the second element is cognitive accommodation. And what that means is that you have difficulties sort of making this fit in your mind. Because once you start really thinking of the night sky, and you start thinking about all these planets, right? I mean, and people have been doing this. We'll get into this, I guess, in a moment. People have been doing this ever since, you know, the Copernican revolution. Like, hey, wait a minute. If this is a sun, it's just a star. There must be loads of stars. Once you start thinking about this, you start, your mind gets completely boggled. You get completely dazzled. You can't take it in. So that's cognitive accommodation. You try to fit this in your world, into your mind. It doesn't quite work. Mm. So those two things together. Mm. So that comes from the psychological literature. But then wonder, it's kind of interesting because wonder doesn't have quite the same research devoted to it in the psychological literature, but there's a lot of philosophical work on wonder. Mm. Now, I look at wonder as basically similar to awe, but not exactly the same, in that, again, you get really focused by something and you notice that there's a lot of things I don't know. For example, you look in a microscope, one of those microscopes at school, it's the first time. You look through a microscope and wow, my hair looks like that. That's kind of creepy, right? And then you think all these things around me are sort of like really creepy like that, right? Mm. And that is, so you have, again, the need for accommodation, for cognitive accommodation, but you don't necessarily have the physical size. So there's a kind of conceptual thing that opens up to you. You can see like, there's a lot I don't know. So that's how I defined it in the book. Both have this cognitive accommodation, both sort of push you to look beyond yourself, to try to learn more about it. But the difference is that awe has this vastness dimension that wonder doesn't necessarily have. Mm.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because if I think about these two things in contrast to maybe other primates or other mammals, as far as we know, it doesn't seem like they have the capacity to do that. It does seem like a very human thing. Are chimpanzees or bonobos or rhesus monkeys, are they looking up at the stars at night and filled with awe? Maybe. But I think, you know, it seems to me that there's a kind of brain development of sorts that's implicit here, of this ability to consider things bigger than ourselves, to have this form of abstraction, to have this form of imagination, different layers of this kinds of things. That's not to say that those other animals don't, but it does seem that we're able to really think and use the kind of cognitive pieces of this, or the knowing pieces of this, in ways that kind of have us connected to other parts of our experience. And so, I don't know, when we place it kind of in that way, what do you think? Do you think that that's, it doesn't make us special, but I think that there is a kind of, there's a difference there of maybe from other animals. What do you think?
Oh, this is such a difficult question, honestly, that I don't know. I go back and forth on this. So here's my archaeology background talking about this. So people have looking for a long time, like, okay, where's this spark where it all began? Was it in Lascaux? Mm-hmm. No, a lot older, like, or Cosquer or Chauvet, you know, one of those French caves. Or was it like in South Africa 70,000 years ago that we see this creative spark? Or is it maybe even longer ago? So you have all this work by McGreaty and Brooks, you know, like hundreds of thousands of years ago, like you have shell beads and things like that.
Yeah.
So I don't know. But I do know that actually, I think actually that an emotion akin to or something similar to it, we do see it in primates. So originally, Jonathan Haidt and Dachel Keltner have this idea that it has to do with the social structure of primates and that they are in awe of, say, like you have awe for an alpha male, for example. Uh-huh. So it's the awe for the alpha male. But one problem with that is that a lot of the awe that we feel is actually not primarily for the alpha people. So there are certainly a demographic, and I'm cognizant of this, is that it's election year in the US again, that some people do have that kind of awe for political leaders, but I certainly do not. I never do. And many people are like that. If anything, I see a political leader on screen, I turn away.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. We have awe for things like mathematical theories, natural landscapes. And so what I think ultimately is there is a lot of our cognitive makeup that is highly similar, but there are specific ways that we use our culture and ways to interact with our emotions to sort of complexify them and to nuance them in ways that you don't have in many other animals. So there's a kind of relationship there.
Yes. So it sounds like there's a kind of definitely a social sort of component, but the cultural aspect of it is there's all these, it sounds like there's all of these kinds of pieces, whether it's sociality, cultural evolution, things like that, that are loaded into a sense of awe or wonder. Because like kind of the example you were saying, right? If it's a kind of an alpha or whatever, I see those things, and maybe there's connections here, but as a kind of reverence or respect, but not necessarily awe. Of course, you can be in awe of political leaders or or whomever. But you know, it could be fear, it could be respect, it could be reverence. While similar, maybe a little bit less different than awe, and I'm assuming there are many dimensions to awe. You know, you can be in awe of, you know, the ocean when, you know, waves just rip something apart, or, you know, obviously the galaxies in the night sky and the universe and all these things. There's different ways, both for other people or for nature or things like that. And it seems that there is a sort of cultural and social component to this. How do you see the loadings there with cultural and sociality?
I think that's very important. So I'm trying, in the book, I'm trying to strike a balance between basically two ideas about human emotions. So on the one hand, you have people like, Darwin and people following Darwin, such as Ekman, and they basically think that emotions are these sorts of innate things. So that there's different emotions that you have for different purposes, basically. So why do you have fear? Well, fear is healthy. If you didn't have fear, you wouldn't run away from, you know, the saber tooth, as they say. Like,
right.
There's only some species of saber tooth that we actually coexisted with. Anyway, so, but there's this other view that emotions are culturally constructed. And Darwin, in fact, he did a bunch of experiments in his house. Did you know about this?
No,
that
I didn't.
In the Downing Street, he showed people pictures of people making all sorts of faces. And then he'd ask people, what does this face look like? And they say, oh, that person is afraid. And there were like only a few categories. And he said, well, that's clearly evidence that human emotions are similar to like animal emotions. And he wrote about that in his account of the emotion in humans and other animals. But then there's this other idea that, they are culturally constructed. And it seems that that somehow, and I hate to say this, that it's a bit of both, right? It is a bit of both. And it's not just like trying to find a middle position between existing positions out there, but just trying to be led by the evidence in that we do know that a lot of our cognitive equipment is really very situated. Like, you can use arithmetic, and many people aren't very good at arithmetic, but still, like, if you stand in a supermarket and you're trying to add up in your mind, like, how much is it going to be, particularly near the end of the month, if you are in that situation, that you can do it quite easily. And why is that? How can you do it? Because you have these sorts of shortcuts and heuristics. And that's just one example. So the situated cognition. And we have this with awe and wonder as well, I think. So I think that we have certain sort of cognitive capacities, but they never are used outside of relevant contexts. So I think in terms of awe and wonder, it really depends on what sort of thing your culture tells you is worthy of awe and wonder. For example, the ocean. The ocean is great, but honestly, like in European history for the longest time, the ocean was terrible. In the old sense of awful, certainly, but it's something that you wouldn't want to mess with or go to. And actually, tourism to beaches and to the sea and so on was like 18th, 19th century. So before that, people just didn't find it aesthetically very valuable, the sea. So that's one example where people at some point started saying, yeah, this is interesting, let's look at this. So it really depends on what in your cultural background people say is valuable to have awful.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. I think that there, I like your middle way. I think it is probably a bit of both there. And not just to find the middle point, but I do think it is a kind of, we live in environments and we live in ways in which we, certainly you, you could live on an island and never interact with people, and you might think that, wow, these things up in the sky are really, you know, they're very spectacular. But I think a lot of the times, a lot of our ways in which we come to things can be definitely instructed by culture and by our environment. So you have this really interesting line in the book where you talk about how philosophy could be born in wonder, which I thought about that for a long time. And it's interesting. I do, if you sit down and think about philosophical ideas or ideas about whether it's metaphysics or it's ontology or it's epistemology or whatever it may be, going all the way back to the Greeks and even people before that and all the way up to whatever current day philosophers are doing, you know, it all starts with a question, or it starts with being curious or being open or trying to do this wonder of sorts. And so I took that to mean as sort of this idea of like, yeah, when has there not been a question? I mean, you can take somebody like, you know, Martin Heidegger, right? Who was really frustrated and had this sense of wonder of like, well, Kant's just making these assumptions. Well, what about actual being, right? What about actually divorcing from, and that wonder to say, well, wait a minute, what are we not? You can do this with any philosopher, I think. I mean, I think, you know, Nietzsche did this all the time. You know, you can pick your philosopher here, but what do you mean, or could you expand on this idea of philosophy being born in wonder and what you mean by that?
Yeah, I think that, so this is the ancient Greek idea of wonder as originating from just, you know, philosophy originating from wonder. And wonder is just something that is a sort of intrinsic part of being human. So in Aristotle, in the Metaphysics, he begins by saying that all human beings have wondered at all sorts of things. They wondered at the night sky. They wondered at like simple things. And then from there, they would go on to complex matters. If we look at Plato in the Theaetetus, it's a little bit different. So with Plato, wonder is seen not as an emotion that is common to human beings, but as specifically one for philosophers, because you have Theaetetus. He's a young, ugly mathematician. This is mentioned several times quite randomly. Like, so, and he says, I'm wondering why. So they have this debate on what knowledge is. And Socrates says, yeah, what is knowledge? Yeah, just tell me what it is. And he comes up with all sorts of ideas about what knowledge is, and they all come short, of course. Like, there's always counterexamples. This is the Socratic method. And in the end, he says, oh, by the God, Socrates, please. I'm just so, my mind is so completely dazzled. I just keep on wondering. And then Socrates says, well, you have the mark of a philosopher, because a philosopher is somebody who wonders. Mm. So that's an interesting difference between, you know, a student and pupil, you know, between Aristotle and Plato, in that the one says wonder is universally human. The other one says wonder is specific to philosophy. Mm. So which one is it? Is it specific to philosophy, or is it universally human? I'm going with Aristotelian idea, mm-hmm. that it's universal for us all. Mm-hmm. But I do think that in philosophy, that you can wander a little bit further. Like, you know, honestly, very often in many, many everyday contexts, if you keep on wondering, people will start looking weird at you and they will say, why are you doing this? Like, there's these really bad sitcoms like Friends and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, I don't know if you watched any of these like horrible Gen X sitcoms.
Yeah.
Where you have usually one.
I'm not a fan.
One intellectual, not a fan, no. But you have one intellectual guy usually there. Everybody's stupid and mm-hmm. this is seen as a great virtue. Mm-hmm. But there is one person who speaks in words that have more than one syllable. And this one person will often sort of go on where everybody else stops, and they will just keep on going. And everybody then goes to this one character because, of course, anti-intellectual as these things are. Please stop it. So I think in philosophy, you can keep on going, mm-hmm. right? So I think if philosophy is a discipline where we can use our wonder, as you were saying with Heidegger, and come up with some new ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that the development, or you could think of like, obviously imagination is important here, but the act of creating something out of something else, or this kind of novelty of certain things, I think has to have an element of wonder, whether it's looking at something differently or trying to see something in a fresh way. And I think, you know, good philosophers or really good thinkers are able to do that. And they're trying to say, okay, well, how do we try to understand things about us as humans or things about the world? You mention a handful of people throughout the book. You talk about Plato and Aristotle, which you've already mentioned. You tell us about Descartes and his passions of the soul. You even talk about Adam Smith, and most people know Adam Smith from The Wealth of Nations, but he also wrote about emotions as well. What do we make about this kind of history from the Greeks all the way to the Enlightenment period and further, of how we've through time seen how people are thinking or contributing to this idea of awe and wonder?
So there's several salient parts of that. So on the one hand, I think there is the continued view in the Western tradition of how does wonder and awe contribute to philosophy? Is it a good thing to evaluate? Is it a good thing to wonder at something, or is it a bad thing to wonder at something? So like in the medieval philosophy, you have this sort of moralizing about too much curiosity. Curiosity is bad. Curiosity is bad, but wonder was something that people still had, and wonder was okay. Wonder was part of natural philosophy. So this is all fine-grained distinction. So actually, medieval philosophy, you have these distinctions that come, and people look more and more at sort of wonders. You know, like wonders could be a two-headed sheep, a girl with green hair, a meteor that strikes, or a meteorite. And here's the interesting thing. So people, natural philosophers basically said, look, these wonders are not real, or it could be a miracle. So they had sort of this thinking about like, it could be that it's a miracle, but very often it shows our ignorance of how the world works. And they would make these systems where you could sort of get all the weird bits out, right? So a lot of medieval philosophy was about getting the weird bits out. But then in the early modern period, I think one thing that I'm working on right now, actually, so it's next project, is that one thing about the early modern period is how people realized that their knowledge was inadequate. Like you had the colonization, you had which opened up lots of worlds. And new ideas and new spices, new smells, like people's phenomenological world just expanded so much. Like imagine eating bland medieval food and then all of a sudden having, you know, all these exotic spices. Like, I mean, if you were an average, reasonably upper middle class person, you could already have those. So people's worlds just expanded. Then you had also the enormous shock of, the Great Plague, which sort of came in waves, which made huge changes in people's demographic makeup. So people got more and more this idea about like this old consensus model that we had with like Christianity and the medieval, it doesn't work. So they started getting interested in weird things again. And I think that is really the thing to try to think in a unified way about early modern philosophy and the Enlightenment is like, let's embrace the weird. Mm. Let's not like to get rid of it. So you had experimental philosophy or science, as we now call it, where people started like doing weird experiments and not just observing nature. And basically where people tried to, and that's the interesting bit. So they saw all these wonders, but they still thought, you know, ultimately, if we know about it, the wonders will disappear. Mm. So there's still a sort of, in the medieval period, people were trying to push away, brush under the carpet, the weird bits. And in the early modern period, people would instead try to make theories that accommodate the weird bits. Mm. But there's still going away, we acknowledge that we are wondering at something, but we don't want to keep wondering. Mm. We want to learn, and that's how we eventually will become less in wonder So wonder is basically a sort of, it's a state, that's how people thought about it, of ignorance. And once you know, your wonder dissipates. That's very broad brush.
Yeah, no, and I think it's interesting. I think the things that are maybe uncharacteristic or things that are somewhat seen as kind of outside the box, you start to say, well, let's examine that, or let's see what's this about and see, okay, well, how do we understand more about these things? We'll take a long footnote here. So there's this debate with people, researchers, many of them I've had on the podcast, about this idea of emotions as being kind of universal. So that it's a human thing that people around the world, they all feel fear and anger and joy and sadness and all this stuff. And then there are other folks that believe that the constructionist model, social constructionist, you know, these are, emotions don't really exist. They're human creations and they're heuristics. And so really is what you make it, right? You have a phenomenological, or you have a subjective experience internally about a certain kind of stimulus or an event or whatever, and you have a feeling about it, right? You have a response to it. You have a phenomenological experience of it. You know, you want to call that fear, fine. Someone else might have not the same experience, but a sort of analogous one, but they might call it a surprise or, you know, whatever. You do mention this in the book, these kind of competing ideas. Two things. One, what do you think about that generally? And does it really matter? And is it really helpful to have these sort of debates of sorts?
Does it matter? I don't know. I think, yeah. So if we think about the original context in which some of this debate occurred before it reached the maturity that it has now, then one of the earliest contexts is the context, as I mentioned, with Darwin. What Darwin meant to show continuity with other animals. So in The Descent of Man, he says, the difference between humans and other animals, great as it is one of degree and not one of kind. I don't know if this is the exact quote, but it's pretty close. And one of the things that he wanted to show in his book on emotions that he published just 1 year after The Descent of Man is that our emotions are similar to those of other animals. So fear is not unique, and anger is not unique, and so on. Like, you have precursors of that sort of emotion in primates particularly, but also in other animals. But then you had sort of a whole research project after Darwin that was a bit degenerative in the end, with people like Romano, I forgot his name. But you had like these early emotion researchers, also William James and other people like that. And they like had these things like jealousy in fish. Can a fish be jealous? Probably not, I would say. So I think there's several things to it, namely our social complexity. So I do think that it's plausible that animals with a social rich life, not just primates, but also, for instance, bats. Bats have very rich social life, that they and some social bird species, they will have some emotions that other animals simply lack by virtue of, you know, the adaptive value of those emotions. Of being in a group, you have to sort of do like cognitive bookkeeping, right? Imagine if you do something for me, I feel gratitude. Why do I feel gratitude? Well, it helps me to repay you. Now, in a sense, talking about how exactly do we call this and that sort of thing does become uninteresting, but I think it is still interesting to see in how far can culture explain, or can we have cultural variations? I still think that's interesting, because in a sense, I don't think that you can explain adequately what goes on with culture and what it does for us if you don't see how it sort of interacts with these internal things. Yeah, that's maybe a good starting point to begin with, but I don't think I've exactly answered your question.
Well, you know, I think I have where I come down on it, but I do. I'm not so dogmatic about it, though. Mm. At least not like how it used to be. In my world, in clinical psych, you know, I take the universalist approach. my view is, yes, there are, I don't know what somebody feels. I never, no, none of us ever will. But we all know what it's like to feel sad. Mm-hmm. Like if you go to a funeral around the world, I don't know exactly what that person is feeling, but I know it's analogous to what I felt at a funeral. It's some mm-hmm. variant of sadness. There's obviously different dimensions to that, and there's certainly different expressions of that. But the intrinsic subjective experience of feeling sad when you lose someone, I think is a universal feeling. How it's expressed is a different story, right?
Yeah.
But to be fair, I mean, you know, yes, the names that we call these things, you know, are they, you know, man-made heuristics that we all put together? Yeah, of course. Yeah, absolutely. That's fine.
Yeah.
Heuristics aren't a bad thing. Heuristics are. It's like when someone has a mental health disorder, right? They have depression or they have anxiety. Do those things actually exist? Not really. What exists is you have a series of symptoms within a certain time frame that has certain impact on a certain person, you know, in these particular ways. Instead mm-hmm. of just citing out common criteria that people feel, we just call that depression. So we don't have to say all those things. That's the utility of heuristics. I just think that sometimes we go a little too semantical about like, well, it doesn't really exist. It's like, yeah, okay, sure. Like the color red doesn't really exist, but we see, you know, red things all the time. And we say that these are symbols. These are heuristics. I think sometimes we can be a little too right. in the weeds on things. So that's kind of where I come on to it is like, I think we have, to be human means we have experiences and we have feelings about those experiences. And we have many similar feelings. I think, yes, yeah. most people know the feeling, the emotion, if you will, of hunger. Many people will say hunger is an emotion. There'd be, again, people debate that and all those things. But many people know the emotion of fear. It's like, well, okay, like, yes, you know, context and environment and what does it look like and you know, what are the degrees of it? But again, I think we know what the experience is like, but we should still be curious about mm-hmm. what the individual person's experience is like. And we should not just say, oh, you felt sad. Okay. You know, go move on to the next thing. It's like, well, what is that experience like for you? Your sadness is not necessarily going to line up with my sadness. You're a different person. You have a different phenomenological experience of the world. That's important to investigate and to know or try to know. And, you know, so I kind of fall on one side of the camp, if you will, in this, but I am open and respectful to other positions that people have. And I can see the utility of the value of it for sure. I don't, even if I don't fully get on board with it. Is that sort of kind of fill in some of the gaps there, what you're saying?
Yes, that's right. So I think indeed, like you'd get mentioned funerals, which is a good,
yeah.
a good sort of side point to just briefly dwell on. So yes, it's bad to lose somebody, but it's kind of interesting, the kind of cognitive technologies, and it's a central concept in the book, the cognitive technologies we develop to deal with that. Mm. So grief, we know, actually occurs in other animals.
Yeah.
It's a cliche, but it does occur in elephants, for mm-hmm. example. Mm-hmm. Elephants feel grief, and they have expressions of it as well.
Yeah.
And you know, various other animals, crows, etc. as well. It sucks if you're a social animal to lose another social animal that you're close to. Mm-hmm. But humans have sophisticated ways to deal with this. It doesn't make the lost person go away, but it helps them to deal with the loss. And it helps them to sort of like, even though you have this feeling of grief, like it is a very basic kind of feeling. But once you give it meaning, you can sort of modulate your own emotional responses further. Mm. And that's something that I think that a lot of our cultural cultural tools do. They help us to modulate our sense of awe and our sense of wonder, for example.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think they're usually trying to tell us something. I mean, I think emotions are, are, you know, however you want to describe it, are usually telling us, okay, how do I have, you know, certain ways of trying to understand certain things, or, you know, it doesn't necessarily prescribe, you know, how you should do things, but it's telling you to be aware of it, to be more mindful of it, at least.
Yeah.
So really interesting part of the book that you had was about magic, which is very interesting. I had a conversation with Nicola Clayton. She does a lot of comparative cognition, and she's done a lot of great work on looking at intelligence or learning cognition in crows and you know, kind of, you know, corvids or what do they call it? Primates with feathers, right? They're super intelligent, super smart. And in our conversation, she talked a lot about this, about magic, how magic is a big cognitive tool in a lot of ways, to know that it's not like there's a bait and switch. There's a trick to it. It's not everything is as you seem, but we all know it's a very interesting concept. And yeah, it was really, really interesting hearing her talk about it sort of from the cognitive learning. Do you look at magic in yours as magic can teach us something about wonder? I mean, maybe the two things are connected, but what is this? You talk about hard and soft magic, and, you know, is an aspect of wonder technology and stuff. So how does wonder kind of come into the picture here with ideas or understanding about magic?
So in that chapter, I argue that magic is a cognitive technology that helps us to wonder at things. The main aim of a magician, I mean a magician in the sense of like Penn and Teller and, you know, David Copperfield and that sort of people, they try to evoke a sense of wonder in the audience. Mm. So they're not actually trying, even though we focus a lot on the trick. So we, you know, people used to think about magic, like people who are not experts on magic, like they think the main thing about magic is that there is a sleight of hand, like a quick thing that happens, and, you know, and that is the whole thing. But actually, that's just one element. So in a magical trick, all the other things next to it, like the scene setting, the mood, the music, are just as important. And yes, there is often, for example, the cups and balls is this trick where actually, as research for this book, I learned how to do the trick. And it's kind of very interesting. I learned to do the trick cups and balls. So cups and balls is you have the ball goes, you put it under the cup, and then the ball disappears, and then it comes back. Wow, how did that happen? Right. And it's interesting when you do it, you keep on thinking, surely they saw that, because it's not particularly difficult. Like, it's a certain move that you do, but people just don't see it because they expect your hands to do different things from what they are doing, basically. And I found that really interesting. So that actually, the trick is not like so central. What is more central is like the general talking, like how are we going to frame this? And wonder is basically what happens is you think it's impossible. It's impossible that the ball disappeared and turned into a lemon, for example, and yet that's what happens. So that's the sense of wonder. That's why I think magic is about one of the purest instances of a wonder technology that we have. And in some sense, actually, I think magic in three senses that I use in the chapter are related. So you have magic in stage magic, performance art. You also have magic in science fiction and fantasy, where it's the same. You're trying to evoke a sense of wonder. And then you have magic in like trying to work wonders, you know, where people actually try as practitioners to make this happen. So I think those three ways of magic are actually related. There's a reason they're all called magic.
Yeah. I think that I think there's still a lot of things we can learn about I say the creation, but this use of magic and understanding more about us as humans and how we interact with it. And I think there's a lot of things. I think the piece that you're describing about wonder, I think is super essential. You also talk about, you talk about religion as well, which also has some magic in it, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly does.
You talk about this cognitive science of religion. You talk about, you know, how there's a lot of connection that religion has. And I have a lot of negative things to say about religion. But I am aware of, I don't know, I go back and forth with this. I am aware of the positive elements that religious beliefs can have for certain people, how it is a pretty good adhesive for communities. Mm-hmm. It's always hard for me to kind of see those things with all of the awful things that are connected with religion, intentionally or otherwise. And so it's hard for me to kind of have both of those things in my head at the same time. But for you, how do you see religion as having this connection with helping us understand either emotion management or wonder or all of these components that you have been talking about here?
Okay, I'm going to make a very slight digression from the book.
No, go ahead. Yeah,
back to it. Yeah, I totally hear what you're saying. Mm-hmm. Like, I was horrified by the reversal of Roe versus Wade. I don't know. I hope that's not political. But anyway, I was horrified.
I mean, I was too, but you can be political if you want.
True horror. Yeah. True horror. Like, I thought, how is this possible? But then, you know, I read a lot on the sociology of religion and the cognitive science of religion. It's a big hobby project, more than a hobby project. I've published on this, right? So I'm interested in, like, why does this happen? And yes, you could say there are some people in, you know, the Supreme Court who really are desirous to reverse this. Mm-hmm. But it wouldn't have happened if it didn't have significant support from part of the American electorate. Mm-hmm. And we can talk about how much percent that is, etc. But even if it's, say, only 20% who think for religious reasons that abortion should never be allowed, it's still a lot, mm-hmm. right? Even if it were only, but it's a lot, it's a bit more than that, but it's not that much more. Mm-hmm. So then you have to wonder about, like, I was trying to come to terms with my very negative reaction to all of this, but I think it's useful to think about, like, the broader question about what is, you know, immediately you think, is religion negative or positive in human life? Dawkins, we've just discussed him briefly, thinks it's a negative, and many people think that. But basically, there were sort of three ways to people in Western culture, mainly defending religion, that are worth thinking about. So the first way is to say that religion is rational. It's a super rational thing. And, like, if you go to, like, YouTube and look at sort of religion podcasts, that's what you hear. Like, oh, here's this great knockdown cosmological argument and you will now become theists, right? That doesn't work. Or then you have the idea, well, maybe religion isn't sort of the super rational thing, but at least it helps cohesion, as you say, to keep societies together, to bind people together. But then the question is, like, okay, look at Scandinavia. Like, there's not many religious people there and they're not falling apart, mm-hmm. right? At least not more so than the rest of us.
Right.
So
right.
they seem to be doing pretty great with, like, 5% church attendance or something like that. But then there's Schleiermacher's idea. So Friedrich Schleiermacher, and he's, like, one of my favorite theologians. And Schleiermacher says, actually, you don't need a justification for religion, because religion is just a human, part of human experience. People will always do it because religion is Gefühl. Gefühl is his sort of slightly technical feeling, but it's used in a technical sense of that you have this religious impulse. Human beings have this religious impulse, and he thinks everybody has it. And that is enough of a justification for religion because it just means to say that religion is part of us, part of our lives. We'll always do it. You know, look at the track records, look at history. So how do you deal with that? Like, and I find it very interesting. I'm now working on the Enlightenment and part of that definitely is an anti-religious impulse. And I think religion is very harmful. But at the same time, I also think religion is a human universal. It is a feeling. Well, it's not a feeling in the Schleier. It's a feeling in the Schleiermacherian sense. So I think that religion is one of the ways in which we deal with all the problems that followed us, like grief. And you can deal with it in a secular way, that's true.
Yeah.
But religions are these very powerful cultural magnets, mm-hmm. precisely because they offer this package deal. And they also help us to deal with the wonders of the world, with these sorts of existential things that we deal with. Religion gives us a way to channel those emotions, those epistemic emotions of wonder and awe. And that's why I think that's how religion is inextricably tied with those emotions.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. Religion is the, it's like a ready-made template. Religion's like a TV dinner for people. It's like, I don't want to mm-hmm. cook. I don't want to think about anything. It's all in there. And I just throw it in. I push a couple buttons on an oven or a microwave and boom, there we go. Dinner's ready.
Yeah. Or if you want to go with that,
uh-huh.
I know quite a few thoughtful people who are like that, but it's more like the pizza, the frozen
yeah.
pizza.
Yeah. Yeah.
You buy a margarita.
Yeah.
But then you say, I don't really want margarita. I want pepperoni. And I want a bit of pineapple on
right.
it because I'm a pineapple and pizza sort of person. And they customize,
right.
right? And I think that's wonderful that people can do that. Mm-hmm. But other people, you know, life is tough. Life is really tough. Like mm-hmm. we, I don't know, like I sometimes wonder how do we do it? Like illness, divorce, job loss.
Yeah.
So many horrible things happening to us, right? That, you know, I understand why people are happy with the frozen pizza just as it's.
Yeah. No, I get it. I mean, I think it was, you know, I think it was Nietzsche that said, you know, not everybody's going to find, some people like the herd mentality. Not everyone's going to have the Ubermensch, right? We're not going to find the Overman. Mm-hmm. Not everyone's cut out for that. And a lot of people don't want to. I had this debate, I think, with somebody recently about this. And I said, listen, I don't think everybody wants to do that, even if they had the chance to. And I just don't think some people are cut out for that. And this person disagreed. I said, if you show them everything and they have the chance, the opportunity to do it, they'll do it. And I'm like, no, they won't. No, they won't. I don't think people are like that at all. I think it's more of, give me the frozen pizza. It's, you know, it's a Tuesday night. I'm tired. Just let me throw it in there and I'll take on some of the toppings or put some on and whatever. It will be fine.
Yeah. I think also that like Nietzsche, I love Nietzsche, right?
Yeah, yeah.
He's one of my favorite
films. Yeah, yeah, he's one of my favorites.
So one thing I think that is difficult with this concept is like, I think it isn't the case that everybody just follows the herd and then there's a few people who don't. Like, I think it's more like a gradient in the sense that even those people who are perfectly happy with you know, frozen pizza, they still want a bit of beauty in their lives. Like, they'll still make their garden beautiful. They still want, you know, so I think that our cognitive technologies, ready-made as they are, help us to do that. So,
yeah.
And religion does that. So that's sort of my fairly positive take on how religion helps us to deal with all.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's, you know, I think I've said this before. I mean, you know, going into, you know, when I travel, I go into Catholic churches all the time and stained glass windows mm-hmm. and the architecture.
It's beautiful.
It's absolutely beautiful. It's just not replaceable. I mean, it's amazing, right? I'm not a religious person anymore, but I love it. It's beautiful. I mean, I'm a sucker for, you know, just like old church hymns, you know? I mean, if I hear, you know, a choir doing a good rendition of How Great Thou Art, I mean, I'll get super emotional. I mean, it's just a beautiful piece of work. I mean, most of Bach's works are, you know, religious pieces. You know, when I hear the call to prayer for Muslims, I mean, it's absolutely beautiful. I don't know. I mean, there are so many things that I think religion does connect people with, you know, awe and wonder and the sense of reverence. And you can create aesthetically beautiful, beautiful things, you know, beautiful, beautiful, beautiful paintings and music and right. architecture. Absolutely. Absolutely. So I agree with that. I mean, I think I definitely like the products of it. I just don't like the ideology and the doctrine and the dogma that's behind it. So I think that's I wish we could get the aesthetics without the dogmatic bullshit, but I don't know if we're there yet. So
that is, I think, a really important element for any sort of secular project. That mm-hmm. is that you have to be able to have this. Mm-hmm. Like you can't have religion monopolize this.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, I agree. Yeah. Yeah. And that's, we haven't figured that out. We haven't figured that out in the secular world. And it's an ever work in progress. So let's go back to, I guess a little bit of philosophy. So another favorite of mine, you mentioned, Merleau-Ponty, and you talk about his ideas about habits being embodied, that help us connect mm-hmm. with our sense of wonder and awe. And so how does, I guess, his phenomenology, and so for listeners, I mean, a reminder that Merleau-Ponty was great for a lot of things, but one of the things about his particular phenomenology was trying to understand how is it through the body, right? How are things embodied, right? Which is, you know, a lot of neuroscientists have come around to this idea too, of how is our experience through our body, that it's not just a shell or something we're walking around in, but that there's an important utility for it. And so how do you understand his phenomenological ideas as connected with our sense of wonder and awe through, you know, habits or other things?
I talk a bit about Merleau-Ponty and habits, also in the chapter on religion, where basically the idea is that you do certain things, and we often think, I make a decision. I make a decision to scroll through social media. But do I really make a decision? No, I don't really make a decision. My decision to scroll through social media and to go to Twitter, which is now called X, and I actually said I wouldn't do anymore, is very much because I have a phone and I put on the phone, see are there any messages? And, you know, the button is there and you just begin to scroll. So that's Merleau-Ponty's idea of there are certain, our environment is like, there's certain things highlight in our environment, and through our habits, we can further highlight those things. And he has this beautiful metaphor in the phenomenology of perception of the arrows that guide a museum visitor. So you have a museum, but you don't just go in a museum randomly. You have arrows that say something like 19th century. And so you go there because you love 19th century art. And similarly, our habits are things that guide us. So we don't just interact with our environment and do things like sort of like I freely make the decision now to go to Twitter. No, it's more like I'm an embodied being. I have my phone. I put the phone on and I just step into this habit. So it's a thing that you sort of step into. Now, stepping into these things, it seems a bit like you're basically giving up your autonomy in a sense. Mm-hmm. But I think, interestingly, that habits create freedom. Because suppose you, it's kind of, I was thinking about this recently, like with Duolingo and the streaks freeze and the streaks. There was a psychologist, and unfortunately, I cannot off the top of my head say who it was, who said there's a big difference between habits and streaks. Mm. Habits are things like if you miss one, it's okay. You'll do it next time, right? I for instance, after lunch when I'm working from home, I pick up my lute and I play some lute music. Mm. But sometimes I don't get to it, but that's okay because I can do it the next day. Whereas if it's a streak and you miss the streak, then you get like completely demotivated and you say, oh no, my so many a day. This is, by the way, thankfully how I got out of this horrible game called Wordle that everybody was playing at some point. like I just lost the streak and I was like, oh my God, I'm so happy. I don't have to play this awful game that I wasn't getting better at anymore, but I was merely doing it because the streak got so long. So habits give you freedom because if you cultivate your habits carefully, then you can do you have this freedom. And it's interesting, but I was reading this study about why young people in France, some of them convert to Islam. So there are some people, young people, mostly of Maghrebian descent, who are not Muslim, but they convert to Islam. And the people ask, why do you convert to Islam? Why would you do that? Because yeah, they are being, there's a lot of discrimination against Muslims. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So why would they do it? And they said, well, I did, you know, I did the Ramadan, you know, just with a friend, and I kind of liked it. I kind of liked not eating and drinking all day. Oh, why did you like it? Well, it's a test of my will. Like I can just like focus. Like I know that during this period, not only do I not eat and drink, but also I have to be patient and kind. And they really like that. And so, in a sense, even though these things like the Ramadan and the 5 times a day prayer seems like an imposition and seems burdensome, it could, in a sense, be liberating if that's what the sort of thing that you're looking for. Mm. So religious habits are things that open your mind to new possibilities. Like if you have a day, like, for example, the Sabbath, where you don't work, then you know, okay, today I don't have to scroll through social media because I'm not going to handle any electronics, right? So the habits, as Merleau-Ponty recognized, who had a very ambivalent relationship towards religion. He was raised Catholic, but he thought, well, he felt hostile towards Catholicism. But he also saw that it does have a lot of habits, like from praying the rosary to going to mass on Sundays, to, you know, those fasting days where you can't eat meat and that sort of thing, that he thought it opens possibilities for people that otherwise wouldn't be available to them. And that's the power of habits. So you have to choose your religion or your habits very wisely.
Yeah, I like that. I like that habits give us a little bit more freedom in making the distinction between that and you know, certain streaks that we have or whatever. I think that that's a really important distinction for us to kind of conceptualize in a better way. So I want to ask about one other big topic here, which you mentioned towards the end of the book, which is this idea of spiritual naturalism, which I think is very interesting. Is, you know, we kind of started with this, you know, in certain examples in the beginning of how awe and wonder of science and the natural world, whether it's on the planet or outside the planet, there's a big reverence we have for those things. You also mentioned Martha Nussbaum, you mentioned Rachel Carson, and some of these ideas about, you know, about nature and about how we can interact in the world with other animals or with other organisms or the planet itself. And so how do we have this idea of a kind of, you know, where awe and wonder connect with, you know, a type of, you know, spiritual naturalism and how that's important?
So again, here, my inspiration was initially Dawkins's work, because he talks about this a great deal. He talks about how a bit more knowledge doesn't necessarily take away awe and wonder. This is, by the way, interesting. It's a discussion that goes all the way back to the 18th century, when you had a lot of debates on the sublime with people like Immanuel Kant. But also you had like Herder, Johann Herder. Mm-hmm. And Herder thought that you can learn a little bit about things and still have awe and wonder. Whereas Kant thought it was more of an emotion that comes out of ignorance. So this was a big debate. And I actually come down to this Herder side of the debate, that it is actually advantageous to know a bit more. You don't have to be ignorant to have a sense of wonder. In fact, when you learn more, you get more wonder sometimes, because there's like new things that you didn't even know about, that they exist, that all of a sudden they come into your mind as something existing. Like, I think many people had this experience reading this book by Peter Godfrey Smith about octopuses.
Oh, yeah.
I forgot what the book is called. Yeah. That book. Everyone's saying, oh my God, octopuses. Look at how weird they are. They're weird, funny guys, right? So before that, we didn't really have a good sense of octopus cognition. Surely I hadn't given that any thoughts. But now, you know, the world's a big place with lots of really, really interesting minds. Like, we often marvel at our own minds, but it's interesting for a moment to marvel at the minds of other animals. And then you can have like questions about like, how do they experience the world? So there's this book by Ed Young that recently came out about experiences in other animals. And isn't it amazing, right? Mm-hmm. So I think the more you know, it's a point that Adam Smith already makes in his History of Astronomy. The more you know, the more you can wonder at things. And that is a good starting point for spiritual naturalism. So spiritual naturalism, in the way that Nathan Moosebaum, Rachel Carson, and other people have thought about it, is, I think, starts out with really taking the world seriously.
Yeah.
Actually, here's where they converge with spiritual religious people like Heschel.
Yeah.
So Heschel says we shouldn't see the world as just purposive, right? If you look at the moon as nothing more than something to mine, something to, you know, to colonize, like, oh, let's all colonize the moon, let's plant a flag there. If that's going wrong. So the moment that you start seeing the natural world completely in utilitarian terms, you've lost it, right? So spiritual naturalism has to begin with taking the world and the other seriously, taking the otherness of other life forms and even of non-living things like, say, the moon seriously. And I think that gives you sense. Like, it's not because, this is a point that Carson makes, it's not because you take those things seriously and you think, oh, wow, the octopus has an amazing mind, and oh, wow, the moon is such an interesting object that you see, and therefore, I will respect it. But you could, right? So it's not automatic that this happens, but it's much more difficult to say, I really not only see this rainforest as I'm going to put cows there and make a lot of beef, but this rainforest has lots of different life forms that are beautiful and their own thing, and yet I'm going to destroy it. It's a lot more difficult, right? So in that sense, you can develop, you know, the kinds of virtues and attentiveness that you need to really engage, I think, with the natural world in a way that would be beneficial, you know, for yourself and for the people around you.
Yeah, that's very, very nicely said. I fully agree with all of that. Which leads me to my last question, which is, you know, how does wonder and awe help us to look at the world with a kind of innocence, a kind of firstness, and to really have a life that is worth living? How do we tangibly do that in our kind of day-to-day life where we don't just let it go by us or we take things for granted? How do we foster that kind of approach or attitude towards life?
It's so interesting that one of the last things that Rachel Carson wrote. So Rachel Carson died of breast cancer, unfortunately, at quite an early age. Mm-hmm. Before she could write her big book on wonder, she was going to write this big book on wonder. She'd even talked to her agent about it. Like, it's such, I think it's deeply sad we didn't have that book. But what people did then was posthumously put together a little book that was basically an article that she wrote for a women's magazine, funnily enough, on helping your child to wonder. Mm. And that has a lot of the ideas and about wonder that she would have done in the book had she written it. And one of the things she says in that article, in that small book, is that wonder helps you to deal with problems. Wonder. People who wonder, she says, are able to deal with, you know, the difficulties in life. They have a source of strength and resilience. So when I read this first time many years ago, I was puzzled. I thought, okay, imagine you get a breast cancer diagnosis. It's very bleak. You know, they didn't have the resources that we have now. I don't know if they had like regular screenings and things like that, but imagine you get a breast cancer diagnosis and there's nothing much you can do. How does wonder help? How does it make you, particularly if you're not a religious person and you're not looking forward to, I don't know, happy afterlife, how does it help you to deal with that? And I think in a sense, one thing it does, so I have no definite answer, is the short bit, but the long bit, is that it helps you to see that there is more out there than your personal concern. So it's a kind of, in philosophy, we have this genre of philosophy called the consolatio, philosophy as consolation. And I think here wonder does also play. Wonder is the thing that underlies, I think, philosophical thought. And it is sometimes very consoling to think that there's a lot more than you, that there's a bigger world out there, that, you know, the little crab will continue to walk. Like, and I don't know, maybe this is why we have so much climate anxiety and, you know, eco-pessimism, etc. Because, you know, the idea that we're all destroying that sort of source of great value is difficult for us to deal with.
Yeah.
But in a sense, you know, there is still a lot out there. And I think that it helps you to sort of get beyond yourself, right? Because wonder is a self-transcendent emotion. So it helps you to get a bit out of your immediate worries, your immediate concerns, your immediate thinking about, I have to do this and I have to do that. No, with wonder, you can simply let things be and just look at them and take them on their own terms. And I think that's just great. Like, we should do that more. Like, we always are pushed to, like, do this. You have to, like, do more. Mm-hmm. You have to, like, make New Year's resolutions, and you have to be more productive, and we have to do more this. Even we have to enjoy ourselves more.
Right.
I'm going to begin to rant.
Right.
But, like, we're not doing it right. Like, whatever you're doing, you're not doing it right. Mm. With wonder, there's no such thing.
Yeah.
Like, you could just let things be as they are. You take them on their terms.
Yeah, no, I like that a lot. There is a lot of forced happiness or forced, you know, relaxation and forced self-care. And it's, you know, it's, I don't know. I understand the spirit of it, but if you're going to tell people you have to take care of yourself or you have to have a good time, like, I don't know. There's a certain point where it's like, this feels like work and a chore. And I don't know about that. So it has this boomerang effect of sorts, which is very strange. Helen, I mean, this has been such a delight. I really appreciate it. As a reminder, the book is Wonderstruck, How Wonder and Awe Shape the Way We Think. So everyone should go out and pick up a copy. It's fantastic. And a big, big, big thanks, Helen, for coming on the podcast and for talking all about wonder and awe and all of your work. I greatly enjoyed the conversation. So big, big, big thanks.
Thank you so much. Thank you.